Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. If you have just joined us, welcome to Radio Islam International. Welcome to the program Family Health Matters. I'm your host, Sister Zeenat. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The time right now is 10 minutes past 2. And before we start our program, I would just like to, on behalf of the board and the staff members of Radio Islam, like to extend our sincere condolences to our our colleague Ismail Bayavriyava and his family. His mom passed away today, and the janaza salah is probably taking place right now. May Allah Ta'ala grant the marhumah maghfirah, nurin hakabar, and jannatul firdaus. Ameen. And may he also make it easy for the family and grant them sabr-e jameel, inshallah. You know, losing a parent is not easy, and especially a mom, no matter how old you are. A mother is a very important person in your life. So Allah make it easy for Ismail Bhai and his family, inshallah, and grant them a lot of sabr, inshallah. Okay, now, first up this afternoon is Female Masail with Sister Zakira and Sarmia. This is a segment where we unpack basic and complex masail pertaining to the women. And the topics that are discussed are seasonal. And yes, you are also free to interact with us via email at za@radioislamlive.com or by texting on the number 082-8492-786, inshallah. And that will be followed by health news. Today we focus on varicose veins. Although not generally life-threatening, varicose veins can be compared to a difficult life, long, torturous, painful, and sometimes ugly. And inshallah, we are also going to be speaking to Gloria Mnisi, the clinical facilitator at Charlotte Meseka Hospital. She's in the pediatric department. And if you're not aware of it, then today is National Diabetic, or rather World Diabetic Day, and the month of November is National Diabetes Month, alhamdulillah. So, and today we're discussing, we're going to be talking about family and diabetes. That's actually the theme, so we'll be talking more about that a little later and telling you more about that as well. A reminder to our listeners that our lines will be open, so if you do have any questions or concerns with regards to diabetes too, then please feel free to contact us. The number to dial 011-854-1548 or 082-8492-786 if you would like to text us. Let's get back to Abba Zakira. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Fazina, jazakallah khair once again for having me.
It's
and inshallah, today what we're going to be discussing with the listeners is something quite common. Mm-hmm. As Abba Zina said, the female masail segment isn't always about things that are, you know, your questions that come about once in a while, but rather we try and focus on things that are common day things as well. So today we're going to be speaking about Salah and the Ha'ila, so the lady in Hayd, and with regards to laws about Salah. Now, perhaps one of the things that occurs most routinely with me is that a sister would send me a text message saying, I was praying a certain Salah and then I found out that I had my Hayd, so what happened? So here's how we're going to basically unpack that one for you. We need to remember, first of all, that Salah is waived off from a woman who is in the state of Hayd. So she does not need to pray Salah for as long as she is in the state of Hayd. And how merciful isn't Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Because those sisters who generally have qada because of a crazy Hayd schedule would know that sometimes now and then, because of miscalculation or something like that, you have one or two qada salas that you realize, oh, I should have actually been reading then, and I didn't, and, you know, you need to pay it back. Now we know that even that one or two become quite cumbersome, because you need to, try and remember which salah was it dhuhr, was it asr, and then to pay it back, right? So imagine if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for the duration of some women get their haid for 5, some 7, some even 10 days, if you had to pay back all those salahs, some of us would probably be paying back 50 salahs. Allahu Akbar. How kind of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to have completely waived off salah from a lady while she's in the state of haid. Now how does this work? So basically, if the lady is in the state of haid and she's praying a farad salah and she feels some sort of discomfort and moisture and she thinks that it could be her haid and she knows that it is around the time of her haid and she visits the bathroom and she finds that, you know, her haid has started, then whatever farad salah she was performing, it's all been forgiven and, you know, waived over, and she doesn't need to do anything about this. She doesn't need to repaint or anything of that. But on the other hand, when she is performing a sunnah or a nafil salah, because fard is something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has stipulated on us, when a lady goes into the state of haid whilst performing a fard salah, it is automatically waived off. Whereas when you are performing a sunnah or nafil salah, this is something that you are necessitating on yourself. So you are going into the act of performing it by making the niyyah and starting out in doing it. So you may be in the second rak'ah of a 4 rak'ah sunnah salah and you start feeling some sort of moisture or discomfort and you go to the restroom after that and you find out that you have actually started menstruating. What will you do then? You will have to make a qadha of that sunnah salah that you were performing. Because in the hadith we learn that any sunnah or nafil act that the person starts and does not get to complete and breaks that sunnah or nafil act, then a person will have to repay that, be it salah or be it fast for that matter. So for this, we must remember that if a lady has the sunnah salah that she started in, she will have to then repay that salah. And yes, alhamdulillah, that covers sunnah and nafil salah. I think one other thing that needs to be covered is the sajda tilawa. Sajda tilawa is performed when a lady hears an ayah of Quran being recited that necessitates a sajda. So if a lady is in the state of haid and she hears the ayah being recited, because she is in the state of haid, the sajda does not become necessary on her. So it's not like she needs to remember that and she needs to perform it when she is in the state of tahir, when she does become zahir. No, it doesn't work like that. She was in the state of haid when she heard it, and hence the sajda will also be waived off her. And in a similar manner that the salah will be waived off her. Alhamdulillah, I think that's where we'll have to leave it for today, inshallah. Abazina Jazakallah Khair for the opportunity and the time. Until we meet again next week. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam and Jazakallah Khair, Sister Zakia, for all that information. Very interesting and, of course, very educational for all of us. Okay, when we well, coming up next is health news, and like I said, we're going to be talking a little about varicose veins, and you know, there's so many women out there that do have, I know men also suffer from it, but mostly women. So let's see what this is all about, varicose veins. Like we said, it's not generally life-threatening, but varicose veins can be compared to difficult life, and, you know, long and torturous, painful, and sometimes very ugly. Now, what exactly are varicose veins? Now, they are basically twisted, widened veins with incompetent valves, and although they are a long-term problem, symptoms can come and go. And some of the common signs and symptoms of varicose veins is, or it would rather include throbbing, aching, cramping, swelling, or a general heavy feeling or restlessness in the lower legs, especially after prolonged standing or sitting. And another common sign is itching or burning around the congested veins. However, if they are particularly bothersome, it may be as well to have them checked out, since they could signal a risk of other circulatory system disorders. So, you know, if you do have any of these symptoms and they are becoming a bit bothersome, then I think the best thing to do is to have them seen to. Skin ulcers near the ankle can represent a severe form of vascular disease that actually requires immediate medical attention. And the most common complications of varicose veins are venous insufficiency, which can cause thrombosis and, you know, other things like rupture and venous status ulcers. Of course, there's many other things that could go wrong, but these are just some of the few that are mentioned. Now, these, you know, these blue-purple road maps, as we would call them, occur most commonly in the legs and the ankles and the feet, but can also occur in other parts of the body. And they appear blue because they contain deoxygenated blood, which is in the process of being recirculated. Basically, they develop when veins just below the surface of the skin are damaged, either due to a genetic weakness in the walls of the veins or an inherited weakness of venous valves, or simply through the aging process and, of course, your lifestyle-related behaviors. You know, the gravity doesn't help the situation either, since blood is naturally pulled down into the lower extremities, whether one is standing or sitting. Veins have one-way valves to ensure that blood is kept moving in the right direction and to prevent it flowing backward. However, when they do become faulty, then the veins tend to fill with too much blood and they get swollen or congested. Consequently, legs can feel very heavy and painful. However, in some people, varicose veins do not produce symptoms. Now, I'm sure there's many people out there that will relate to all that I'm saying right now, you know, all that heaviness in the legs and the, your legs feeling so painful, and it's just very difficult. So maybe you do have varicose veins, and if they really become bothersome, you really need to see a doctor. Now, like I said earlier, it's more prevalent in women. Although anyone can develop varicose veins, we said earlier, women are 2 to 3 times more prone to developing them than men. And there are several reasons for this. For example, women are often in occupations that require prolonged or uninterrupted standing. Example, nurses, you know, they have to be standing there and working almost all day on their feet. That's one of them. Waitresses do the same thing. Mothers in the kitchen and in the home, busy all day long, which can cause pressure-related damage to veins or valves. Fatigue makes existing varicosities worse as well, and female hormones are additional predisposing factors. So during times of hormonal flux, such as menstruation, pregnancy, or the menopause, they may be, you know, during menopause, they become a little worse. Pregnancy and obesity, sometimes they start during pregnancy. You know, you may not have had any of these things, and now that you are pregnant, you notice all these veins coming up. Well, pregnancy and obesity, and if you are overweight, are possibly the higher risk culprits, since increased pressure within the abdomen may increase or aggravate susceptibility towards developing varicose veins. Pregnancy also increases the volume of blood in the body, but decreases the flow of blood from the legs to the pelvis, and both pregnancy and obesity cause changes in blood pressure that can have negative effects on venous flow. And when the blood does not flow, you know, flow back towards the heart in the normal manner, the tendency for it to pool in the veins is increased, and with it comes the risk of developing varicose veins. Also, drugs such as birth control pills and hormone replacement therapy may also increase the risk of developing varicose veins. So women of childbearing age, mothers with young children, and of course older women, especially those with sedentary lifestyles, would join those in this high rank, or this high risk rank rather. Unfortunately, varicose veins tend to increase with age, so the condition embodies an element of built-in absolescence. From the time that humans started standing and walking upright, pressure in the veins of the lower body naturally increase as part of our evolution. So it is natural for this to happen. You can't sometimes help it. If you're one of those that's going to get it, you're going to get it. But you need to be able to take care of it as well. Now, what do you do once you have them? Okay, there's lots of treatments, and there's conventional medical treatment. Natural medicine treatments, herbal medicines, essential oils, all of these things that can actually help it. But I just want to talk a little about the conventional medical treatment. They say a common conventional medical treatment for small varicose veins and spider veins is sclerotherapy. Now, this procedure involves injecting a high concentration of an irritant solution into the veins. This whole process eventually will lead to disappearance of the vein. Significant varicose veins are often due to great saphenous vein reflux, and they may require more radical treatment, such as surgical removal or stripping, which also involves removing and ligating the offending veins. Now, this procedure carries the usual general anesthetic risk and it is not always 100% successful, as recurrence rates are high. So it can come back. Even if you go for these things, it may happen and may come up again. Then another surgical procedure, there is another one. It also removes the veins through small skin incisions and is less invasive than classic stripping and ligation. An even less invasive medical technique with a lower risk of complication is some form of laser therapy. Now, this procedure is performed under local anesthetic, and it involves placing a laser into the vein under ultrasound guidance, which causes thermal injury to the lining of the vein, and it also allows it to collapse and to seal. So there's a lot of things that can actually be done, medically that you can do, but unfortunately it can recur. Then if we look at self-help, regular exercise, raising the legs, rest, or the use of appropriate support stockings are specialized, these are specialized elastic compression stockings. They may be sufficient in simple cases. In about 50% of cases, the condition is familial, so it's important to practice preventative health care if it runs in the family. If you know it's in the family, then you know that you may end up having it, then you should do some preventative health care. The most important self-help activity is regular exercise and avoiding prolonged pressure on the veins so that blood flow is not impeded. If you know that this is a possibility, then try and prevent it by obviously doing your regular exercises and not putting too much of pressure on your veins. That means standing for long hours. They say tight elastics such as garters, socks, panties, and or any other over-restrictive garments, as well as sitting with crossed legs or wearing high-heeled shoes. Well, this diminishes calf muscle activity. This should be avoided. So all these ladies out there, we always like to wear all those tight underwear to keep us slim and trim. But you need to be careful, wear it for a little while, but not all the time. Constipation also contributes to varicose veins. So eating high fiber foods, whole grains, and lots of fresh fruits and vegetables to promote good bowel function is so important. And for those people smoking, believe it or not, smoking is another serious risk factor. So if you are smoking, then try and stop immediately. Then, of course, there's natural medicine treatments. Now, for this, obviously, you need to go to a natural health practitioner who would be able to give you the proper medications. And then herbal remedies, essential oils. There's so much that you can actually do. But care needs to be taken not to massage heavily beneath a varicose vein, please, you know, we sometimes when our legs are so sore, we tend up, oh, let me just go for somebody to massage my feet. But please be careful about how you massage them, especially if there is any history of thrombosis. Be careful not to, rub over or under those veins. Unfortunately, there is no simple cure for varicose veins, but prevention and the application of healthy self-care treatments or consulting qualified health specialists can play a significant role in managing the condition. So now you know what these varicose veins are all about. So I think it's important for us to try and prevent it from happening. And just make sure that you do your exercise and not to stand on those legs for too long. You know, stand, but take your little rest now and again in between so that there's not so much of pressure on the bottom part of your legs, inshallah. Well, when we return, we'll be talking to Sister Gloria Mnisi. She's the clinical facilitator at Charlotte Maseka Hospital in the pediatric department, and it's National Diabetic Month, or Diabetes Month, November, and today, the 14th of November, is World Diabetes Day, so it's all about diabetes today, so stay tuned, we'll be back in a few moments. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. If you've just joined us, welcome to Family Health Matters. I'm your sister Zeenat. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, the funny thing about being diagnosed with a chronic condition is that it forces you to look at life and more specifically at your health in a far more urgent way. Well, joining me is Gloria Mnisi, the clinical facilitator at Charlotte Maseka Hospital. She's from the pediatric department, and we're going to be talking about diabetes, and like I said earlier, it's World Diabetes Day today, so it's the 14th of November, and the month of November is National Diabetes Month, so there's going to be a lot happening during this month to bring about awareness about this chronic disease, diabetes, to everybody out here, in fact, around the world. It's something that's happening right around the world. Anyway, Gloria, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It's been a while, but it's lovely to have you with us in the studio again.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for the opportunity. Yes, it's been a while. You know, things have been happening, and I didn't get an opportunity. But I'm grateful for this opportunity to come and discuss the most important thing that affects us all, you know, worldwide, not just in South Africa. Thank you.
So, but, you know, how serious really is diabetes in the world, and maybe in South Africa as well, because we live here, so we need to know how bad it is here too.
It is actually very serious. If we look at the statistics from 2017, these are the latest statistics. Worldwide, there's 145 million people that are living with diabetes mellitus. And over and above that, in Africa, there's 60 million people with diabetes. If we cut it further down, South Africa, 2.3 million people that are living with diabetes mellitus. And it has been found that South Africa and Ethiopia are the highest in Africa. So that actually tells us that this is very, very serious. And it is projected that in 2025, more or less 41 million people will be living with diabetes. Think about it. I'm talking about 2017 stats, and we are at the end of 2018. So probably these stats are much, much higher than the records that we have at the moment. So this makes it a very important issue for families to take serious, and also for health workers, you know, to educate and support the people that are living with diabetes mellitus.
Hence, you have this special day and this special month during the year, you know, awareness month and awareness day. So tell us more about that. What is this day all about?
The day, our theme is family with diabetes. So if you, as you can see, the theme is not only concentrated on the person that is living with diabetes, but it's concentrating on the family as a whole, which means the broader family, the nuclear family. Family will also be your health providers, the people you go to church with, the people you play sports with. Those people become your family because you're sharing a common goal. So it's to educate and enlighten all those people around the person that's got diabetes to be aware and be able to support the person with diabetes and actually make the lifestyle as simple and attainable as possible.
Mm. Yeah, so this is happening now, but, you know, it's so startling, you know, listening to all these statistics that you just shared with us. It means it is so common. It's in almost every home you would possibly find somebody that has diabetes. So, and I think one of the things, till this day, I don't quite understand what diabetes is all about. I mean, I've been doing programs, but I don't know exactly what it is all about. So maybe today, I'm going to listen to you very carefully and hope to understand it even better. What exactly is diabetes mellitus?
Actually, before I explain what diabetes is, if we look in South Africa, diabetes mellitus has been found to be the highest killer in females. But think about it, we are big. We become relaxed once we are married, we have babies, you know, we want to show that I'm this big mama in the family. And also our cultural backgrounds are pushing us to thinking that being big means you're powerful or you're strong or you know or you have money or things like those. But on the contrary, hypertension is the highest killer in males in South Africa compared to diabetes mellitus. It also makes sense. Look at how men eat. You know, if you go out there, they'll be eating this big chunk of meat. You know, that it's also a symbol of being masculine. They'll be drinking all those fizzy drinks or those beers. You know, that's a status kind of. It's a symbol of being a man. So, hence this family with diabetes. You know, to look at all of us as family members, how do we contribute to actually having this condition in our families? But in short, diabetes mellitus is a chronic disorder. That's unfortunate. Once you have it, it's not going to go away. It becomes a chronic disorder of metabolism. So this disorder means whatever you eat, whatever is in your body, is going to be metabolized incorrectly because now there's a disorder. It is characterized by partial or complete deficiency of the hormone insulin. You see, so now we're talking more complications because it starts off being a problem with the pancreas. It's either it's not secreting enough insulin to digest and transport all the glucose and the carbohydrates into the cells, or it's not secreting at all.
The insulin is a very important
thing. It's a very important part of our metabolism. Because those tissues, to be able to perfuse, for them to grow and support your body, support your organs, your essential organs, they need this glucose, they need the carbohydrate, they need protein, and for those things to be transported into the tissues, they are using insulin as a vehicle. So once the pancreas is affected, there will be a whole lot of disorders that are happening in the whole body. You'll find growth is retarded, you'll find weight is disturbed. You are either becoming too fat or you're going to become too thin. Your skin is going to change. You either become too dry, because you'll see that as we unpack the signs and symptoms, that how does it get to a point where you become too fat? Because now the insulin is not able to transport these carbohydrates into your fat cells and be able to break it down to be utilized by the body. So it will accumulate and cause those tissues to just contain fat that is not metabolized. The protein is not going to be utilized. How is your heart going to work if you are not having that energy to get the heart muscles to pump? Your gut is not going to digest that food because there's no energy to help the gastric motility, you know, that chunk of food to go down, be digested, and eventually get eliminated. So can you see how complicated it becomes just from that metabolic erratic problem?
Okay. And what are the causes of diabetes then?
Like I have alluded, it is a disorder of metabolism. For type 1 diabetes, it just happens, because type 1 happens to children. It becomes abrupt. But also, there are genetic predispositions. You know, people that have come from a family that have a gene that predisposes them to diabetes mellitus, that those people can have an unfortunate situation of having diabetes. Hence, it's also important to know our genetic trails, you know, so that we can modify our lifestyles to prevent those genetic problems that we might have. You will never inherit diabetes, but you may have a genetic predisposition to diabetes mellitus. With type 2, it's, you know, an error of metabolism, and it can also be a lifestyle problem that can lead to diabetes mellitus. For type 1, the age of onset would be under 20. Can you see? Under 20, you're not exposed to a lot of all these other things that we have spoken about. Mm-hmm. But for type 2, would be from 20 upwards. Mm-hmm. So it's more the older people that would have diabetes.
So in other words, this type 2 is something that can just come up. It can just happen to you.
It can just happen to you, but it can also be a genetic predisposition. Mm. But it will be progressive. Mm.
It happens after the age of 20.
Yes,
okay.
But it will be a slow happening. Whereas with type 1, it will be abrupt.
Oh. Yes, okay, now I understand.
Can you see that? Mm. So with type 1, you might find this child was fine, been growing well. You didn't even have any signs to suspect that the child might be diabetic. And then they collapse. They go into coma because their blood system is so full of glucose, and it even affects the functioning of the brain. Then they go into a coma. It's only when you've now taken them to a doctor or to a hospital and you find that we do tests like a urine test, where we would collect the urine, put a dipstick, and we'll find a lot of sugar
mm-hmm.
on the urine, and we'll find a lot of ketones on the urine. That tells you that things are not being digested and absorbed. Can you see that? Some of the things is because diabetes is about sugar. You find it causes an osmotic pressure. Sugar is sweet and it's sticky. It would want fluid to dilute it. So you will find that the water gets drawn out of the vasculature, out of the veins, outside the veins, and you have this thirst. You have this persistent thirst, and you drink a lot of water because you are trying to dilute this sugar. And also your body is feeling dry, even though you have the fluid, but it's outside of the veins. It's not being utilized properly. It's a metabolic thing. So you become very thirsty. You pass a lot of urine frequently, and you become hungry. You feel hungry because that food that was supposed to go to the abdomen and support all your tissues, it's not going there. It's sitting outside of the vasculature. And you eat a lot, but you still don't feel full because the food is not being utilized. So those are some of the signs that you will see. And even though you're eating a lot, you still lose weight. You're eating,
yes,
but you're not benefiting from what you are eating. So you lose a lot of weight. You go to the bathroom a lot. You wake up in the night wet. So all that fluid is coming out.
So that's a lot of perspiration.
Yes. Mm. And you have muscle wasting. You know, you become malnourished. Your muscles can show that you are wasted because now you are not, your metabolism is not supporting your body. And then the other thing you would find, you feel hungry. You eat a lot, but you're not benefiting from what you are eating. Sometimes with children, you find the child was already toilet trained or is even a 12 or 13 year old, but they have nocturnal enuresis. They wake up, they've wet the bed.
Oh, so this could be one of the
signs. It could be one of the signs, yes. It could be one of the signs because the fluid is outside the cells. And when you are awake, you would be going to the bathroom very frequently. But now you are sleeping and you are tired because your tissues are not being supported. So when you sleep, you're like dead. You won't even feel that you are now, your bladder is full, you need to go and urinate. So that also can predispose them to infections. You know, with this frequent micturition of sugar, urine, they can have an infection. A sugar medium is a good medium for infection. So they will also present with urinary tract infections, even ulcers that do not heal, because there's nothing that is providing proteins and nutrients to that area to make the sore to heal. So it's quite a very devastating condition to can have if it's not managed properly.
So if children do present with some of these, especially children I'm talking about, if they do present with things like, you know, bed wetting, continuous bed wetting, you know, like things like little ulcers, like you mentioned, that's not coming, you know, not a healing kind of thing. It's something that you should definitely see to, have it seen to immediately.
Yes, that's something that you need to worry about. It may be a psychological thing that they are bedwetting. You know, children react to situations differently. It may be a psychological thing, something that is happening in the family which they do not agree with, and they do not have the voice to can say, I don't like it when you fight, or I don't like it when you come back drunk, you know, things like those. But you also need to have at the back of your mind to think about diabetes.
Yeah, and if it, and especially like you say, if it is in the family,
yes,
then you should be a bit concerned. Nobody said it's going to happen, but you need to be concerned.
You need to be concerned. Mm. And sometimes there can be a report from the school to say, this person is sleeping all the time. She can't keep her eyes open.
Oh, so that's also a
concern. That's also another thing, because now the brain is not getting nutrients. So you can't concentrate, you just fall asleep, you don't have energy. Because now the cells, the insulin is not able to transport the nutrients across to support the brain. You know, so quite a number of things that could be happening which would need to suspect diabetes mellitus.
Okay, we take a short break. When we return, inshallah, we continue talking about a little bit about the treatment of diabetes and also the role of the family, inshallah. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a few moments. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. If you have just joined us, welcome to Family Health Matters, and we're talking to Gloria Mnisi. She's a clinical facilitator at Charlotte Missaka Hospital. She's in the pediatric department, and we're talking about diabetes. It is World Diabetes Day today, that is the 14th of November, and it's also Diabetes Month, National Diabetes Month, month of November. Now, we want to talk a little about the treatment now. Gloria, what is the treatment for diabetes, especially in children?
Okay.
And we can talk a little about adults as well.
All right. Before I can go into the treatment, I just want to add, you know, for type 1, it could be an autoimmune disease. You know, autoimmune meaning your own cells are fighting against themselves. You automatically become, you react to your own cells. And it could also be exposure to precipitating factors, like an event of a viral infection. If a person have a viral infection, that can precipitate them to and affect their pancreas in producing insulin properly and being able to maintain the metabolic processes. With type 2, it is most likely to be influenced by stronger yet unknown genetic factors. Like I said, it has a genetic predisposition, but it doesn't necessarily mean that when you have family with diabetes, you're also going to have diabetes, but it means you are at a higher risk of having diabetes. The diet also, it can be a cause of diabetes mellitus. If you think about it,
in other words, you can bring it up by the food you eat.
Cow's milk has been found to be one of the predisposing factors to diabetes mellitus. Remember when we talk about child rearing, we encouraged breastfeeding more than formula feeding or even cow's milk. If you're going to give your baby cow's milk, they must be at least above 1 year old. By then, their immune system has been established from the antibodies that they have found from the breast milk. If you're not going to be breastfeeding, at least formula milk, because it is more closer to breast milk than cow's milk is. And then a possible trigger, cow's milk is also a possible trigger of an autoimmune disease. It can make you sensitive. It can make your cells to be sensitive and fight against themselves. Hence, we don't like children having cow's milk before they've reached the age of one. Viruses, things like mumps, Coxsackie virus, and rubella. If you think about it, these viruses, we immunize the children. It's in the regimen of immunization. And the rubella, the mothers, they get tested when they are pregnant. In their first trimester of pregnancy, they get tested for rubella, and if they are found to be positive, they get immunized so that it doesn't affect the unborn child. So those are other things that can cause the diabetes mellitus, that can predispose to diabetes mellitus. But then when we come to the treatment, children, because it's autoimmune, it's abrupt, they are treated with insulin. Insulin is an injectable. There's insulin injectable and insulin tablet. But for children, it's mainly injectable. For adults, it would be mainly tablets. And it is such a thing to treat children with insulin. Insulin is to bring the sugar levels down. But as you want them to be down, they can be lower than what you want. So you do the insulin, and you also support it with the diet. Hence, if you know about diabetics, they will have 8 meals per day. It's not 8 full meals. It would be 4 meals with 4 snacks in between. Because you don't want the sugar to go right down, or you don't want it to go right up. So you're trying to maintain a balance. If you get insulin and you're not going to eat for the next 4 hours, then your sugar goes right down. You go into hypoglycemic coma. If you eat a huge meal and not have your insulin in between, according to how it has been prescribed, you go into hyperglycemic coma, which is now your sugar is far much higher than your body can tolerate. Can you see? It's a very difficult a balance to maintain. Hence, our theme here being family with diabetes.
Yeah.
Because to strike that balance, you can't do it alone. I mean, if people will be sitting next to me having chips and all this junk food, and I'm supposed to be chewing on an apple, that can't be funny.
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
So what would you say, what exactly now, tell us more about the role of the family with regards, you know, improving the health for people who, you know, the people in the home that has diabetes.
Yeah. The role of the family is, you know, to change the lifestyle, adapt to the diabetic lifestyle.
So basically what we're going to be doing now as a family, if somebody is diabetic, then everybody needs to assist that person to get better and to maintain his health, or you know, to keep it person, you know,
sugar levels,
like we all have to basically go on to this kind of diet.
Exactly, exactly.
So make sure he can or she can eat right,
yes.
You know.
Eat the same kind of food, cook the right, you know, cook for everybody. Imagine if you are the only one with diabetes and you're the mother in that family and you have to cook and bake cake, sweet cakes for everybody else, and you look at it. It's not fair. So if we turn the coin and say, you the mother, you can eat the cake, I'm the child and I can't eat the cake. So, you know, that's where support comes into play. You can't say to me, you must go and exercise, go and do your skipping rope, 20 skips in 20 minutes, and you're sitting on the couch and reading your magazine. So, you know, support comes in that way. If you say to me, I shouldn't be drinking fizzy drinks, then you shouldn't go to Pick and Pay and buy fizzy drinks. You know, that's the kind of support. You need to make a relationship with the healthcare providers, the people that are looking after this person that has got diabetes. Get educated. Know the pros and cons. Know the signs of hyperglycemia. Know the signs of hypoglycemia. Be aware of the body of this person. Look out for things like ulcers, because those things are not going to heal, because this person does not have the capacity to regenerate the tissues. So your support is basically to adapt to diabetic lifestyle and be there for this person.
Which basically would be a healthy lifestyle.
It's a healthy lifestyle.
So it's good for all of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Charlotte, for sharing all that information with us. I'm sure there's so much that we can actually talk about. Maybe we can do another program on it again and, you know, just go into more detail with regards to this diabetes itself. But thank you very much for coming in and doing this program with us, and I hope our listeners out there have just benefited from this as well.
Thank you for the opportunity. Just to say, there's a support group. It's called Youth with Diabetes. They host camps. They do educational campaigns at the camps. They teach the children and they talk to the patients. But at Charlotte Matlake, at the area 256, that's where the children with diabetes are being managed. The contact number is 011-488-3256.
Okay, thank you so much. If you want those contact details, you can contact us at the radio station. Jazakallah, thank you so much once again for coming in to do this program with us, Sham.
Thank you so much. Looking forward to having another program like this.
Mercy.
Bye.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.